So, I hear you've been all around town trying to ask about the witch killer. The witch was dead, and then there was a witch killer walking about. You know, she stayed here the evening she arrived, right?
We told the Munchkin authorities, but they didn't think it was important to ask any further questions. She came inside, slept in our guest room, but there is one thing I'll never forget. The sight of those silver slippers she had on when she walked in.
Yeah, those slippers, they frighten me. But they were, without a doubt, silver.
From the wonderful land of Oz, this is Fiction Crime Time. I'm your host, Adam Farmer. I want to start off today's episode by talking a little bit about the reliability of witness testimony. I got pretty excited last episode about what Bach and Onessa had to say about the color of Dorothy's slippers. It seems like a pretty trivial thing, but my job is to find cracks in the narrative to try and find the truth. In many criminal justice systems, witness testimony can be considered unreliable. Memory can be accurate to a point, but in most cases, eyewitness testimony has to be corroborated by the physical evidence. Without the physical evidence, the case begins to be a simple battle of he said this and they said that. In this particular case, the witness testimony collected by the OBI was corroborated by the evidence. The ruby slippers were picked up in the castle of Glinda of the South, and witnesses from each crime scene claim those were the slippers worn by Dorothy when she was on her killing spree. Of course, there were a few discrepancies from witnesses who didn't notice the color of the slippers, or probably weren't even asked. But still, the strong majority of the witnesses corroborate the evidence of the ruby slippers being the exact slippers taken from Ebony by Dorothy. Now, all of that being said, why the heck am I focused on a simple pair of shoes? Well, simply because this is the crack in the narrative. This is the ingredient that doesn't gel. This is basically all I have right now. This may be a red herring, and I may be chasing down a white rabbit. But this is at least a starting point. In order for me to be fully invested in the story of the slippers being silver and not ruby, I need to rule out the possibility of Bach and Onessa being unreliable witnesses. If they run around telling fantastic stories that nobody believes, then I may just be wasting my time believing them. I decide to do some digging into their reliability. At first, I was hesitant to ask other citizens of the city because of their kind hospitality towards me before. But after spending some time in the city and getting to know a few of the citizens, and also mentioning that I knew Bach and Onessa, they began to warm up to me a bit. I told them my situation and came back with some pretty interesting stories.
Oh, I remember Bach. He and I dated a little back in high school. He was such a sweetheart. I don't know why I let a guy like that go.
Oh yeah, Bach and Onessa had the best barbecues. I remember one time, just a few months ago, before all this stuff went down, they were hosting one in their garden. You saw how beautiful it is, right? With all their flowers and lawn decorations and stuff. Well, anywho, one of them birds swooped in from the sky. You know, what are they called? A jay or something. Well, it swooped in, and you know Bach always forgets to put the cover back on the grill. Well, this bird, you know, the jay, just sort of swoops in and grabs up a wiener off the grill. Bach didn't know whether to laugh, cry, or be proud of that young bird. All I know is he keeps the cover on his grill from then on. They're good people over there. That's all I have to say.
I was the school librarian when Onessa was in high school. She was always reading books, trying to study, find a way out of Munchkin City, but she couldn't run away from that small town life. She loved it too much. She always says hello when you walk past her on the street. Her and Bach were a great match.
For the most part, Bach and Onessa seemed like all-around good and reliable people. They seemed to have made quite an impact on this town and have many friends. Of course, that doesn't exactly stand as a basis for having a reliable memory. And that's what I'm looking for. Corroboration of them being reliable witnesses. Proof that their memory can be trusted. I'm not questioning their personality or likability. After just a few hours of talking with them, I know for sure that they are likable people. But even the most likable person can have a bad memory. I, for one, am absolutely terrible at remembering names. Every time I meet a new person, I have to repeat their name over and over again in my head so that I'll be able to remember it. So, I need proof that tells me their memory is reliable enough to believe that they remember the slippers being silver. And I think I found it.
I hear you're asking about Bach and Onessa. Something about wondering if you should believe a story they told you?
Yeah, is there anything you can tell me? I'm looking into the murder that happened here a few months back. Bach and Onessa told me that the suspect stayed at their house. I just don't know if I can believe all that they told me about what they saw.
Well, yeah, they told me that story too, about the witch killer. I almost didn't believe it myself until I remembered Onessa's art hobby.
Wait, her what?
Yeah, she has a hobby where she paints pictures by memory. Really accurate stuff. She even has some pictures of me in there. If they told you they saw something, they definitely saw it. No doubt about that. I'm surprised she doesn't already have a painting of it yet.
I do remember seeing some paintings hanging up around their house, but I don't remember seeing any with a little girl wearing silver slippers and her dog. I didn't think anything of the paintings when I saw them. Apparently, they were painted by Onessa to mostly complete accuracy. So if she can do that accurately and entirely by memory, then maybe I can find myself believing their story. But I'm still not fully there. Yes, they have a reliable memory, but that does not change the facts. And the facts say that the slippers were ruby. I think I've exhausted this part of the investigation. I believe them, but I'm torn. Like I said before, I look at the facts, not my own assumption. I believe them. I believe that they are honest in telling the truth, but the facts say otherwise. What do I choose to believe? The facts or my gut? The witness testimony corroborated by evidence? Or the witness testimony not corroborated by evidence? This is the predicament faced by many investigators. This is the predicament Jacob is facing. What is the truth? Evidence or belief? The more I dive down this rabbit hole, the more I understand what Jacob is going through. I find myself believing my gut more than the facts. But what does that mean? I don't know. All I know is that I'm stuck here. And I won't leave until my gut and the facts are on the same page. And use them both as a lens to see the truth. I recognize that sometimes during this investigation, it may seem like I'm trying to clear Dorothy's name or undermine the OBI's investigation. I just want to set this straight before I go further. It's not my intention to do those things. I'm just a guy looking for answers. I want to find out what happened to Ebony Arewood, Bruno Bacchus, Ivory Irewood, and the many other lives that ended too short. My main purpose is to find the truth and to bring justice for the victims, and in so doing, helping Jacob become satisfied with the case. That being said, the more I ask around in Munchkinland, the closer I get to the first victim, Ebony Arewood. During this past week, I visited the crime scene. It was a weird feeling being there, a little bit because of how this was where she was killed, but also because this was where it all started. This was the beginning of the blood-stained yellow brick road, the beginning of a killing spree that will be written in history books in the coming years. The house where Dorothy lived, used as a weapon. There's a barricade surrounding it because construction teams are working to remove it. There's a group of protesters pressing on towards the barricade. They're protesting against the removal of the house, saying that it should be turned into a landmark and a memorial in memory of Ebony Arewood. Munchkin authorities have lined up behind the barricade to keep the protesters at bay. I try to maneuver my way through the protesters to get a better look at the house. It's a small, one-story house with maybe only one or two bedrooms. I make it to the barricade, where I can see the side of the house lifted up and put on blocks so they could pull Ebony out from under it. There's even a small indentation left in the ground where her body was. Looking at it, everything began to seem real. Before, it only felt like I was going through the motions of a normal day at work, but being here, among these protesters, looking at the spot where Ebony died, it all felt real. Ebony Arewood felt real. Dorothy Gale felt real. I know I'm supposed to be an unbiased reporter, but in this moment, I don't want the house to go. I can't explain it. In terms of this case, this is a sacred place. The last place where Ebony was alive. And it's being destroyed. The demolition crew is pulling pieces of furniture and wood out the front door of the house in preparation for the full dismantling. They would use a wrecking ball, but because of the proximity of other houses in the area, they decided it would be best to dismantle it piece by piece. I can also assume they're doing this to see if there is any evidence left in the house that they may have missed. After standing at the barricade for a few minutes, a member of the Munchkin Authority walks up to me and asks me to back up, saying I was too close to the barricade. I back up into the group of protesters. The last thing I want to do is to bring too much attention to myself before I get a chance to talk to the mayor. But while I was there, I saw an opportunity to interview some of these protesters to get a sense of why they're protesting. And hopefully, in so doing, I can get a sense of who Ebony Arewood was to the citizens of Munchkinland.
It's just not cool, man, what they're doing. Ebony meant a lot to this community, and she should get some sort of memorial to remind us who this witch killer took from us.
She was, like, totally wicked, bro. But, like, in a good way. She was the baddest witch in town. Everyone loved her.
I just don't understand how Mayor Browinian can let something like this happen. I mean, Ebony was pivotal to the success of this community. When Oz the Great and Powerful made the proclamation that said a witch needed to be placed in each of the four lands, she stepped up to the position instead of letting an outsider in. She represented what it meant to be Munchkin, and we will never forget it.
Ebony was the best friend I've ever had. You deserved better.
In the last episode, before I had this experience, I often referred to Ebony as the first victim, reducing her to only what is in the investigation file. This experience reminded me that Ebony Arewood was a person. She was born on the seventh day of Sapphire in the fifth year of the Poppy. She was 28 Earth years old when she died. She was a person, just like any of us. She had friends. She had relationships. While exploring this scene, I walk over next to the house where a memorial had been placed. It has photos of Ebony, poster boards with messages written on them, and notes to Ebony. There are a few candles surrounding the memorial, and I see someone kneeling before it in tears, while another person gently rubs her shoulder, trying to comfort her. It has been 3 months since the death of Ebony Arewood, but it's clear that the impact is still fresh in the hearts and minds of these people. She loved, and she was loved. She was a pillar of this community, and her death has left its scar. A scar that is deep. It may heal over time, but the mark will still remain. While I ask more questions about Ebony around town, I get a better sense of what I first believed to be only rumors surrounding Ebony and the mayor. Apparently, she was in fact seeing him on a regular basis, going to dinner, seeing a performance at the theater, that sort of thing. After hearing what the people around town had to say about it, I feel comfortable enough saying that the rumors are no longer rumors. Mayor Myas Browinian and Ebony Airwood were in a relationship for a few months before Ebony died, though, according to friends, they broke up around 2 weeks before her death, which is probably why there was nothing substantial about it in the file. They were apparently hoping to repair the relationship the week she died, which is why the mayor was with her that day. Ebony had no living next of kin, so Mayor Browinian took custody of the body and took care of the funeral arrangements. I wasn't able to get a good sense of how Myas was taking all of this. He shut himself off from social life and only stuck with work-based activities. People have tried to get in contact with him to ask him to stop the demolition of the house, but no one has been able to get through yet. So, why do I think I can reach him? To be completely and transparently honest, I don't. I'm running on some very thin fumes of hope right now, but I know I have to try.
You've reached the office of Mayor Browinian. This is Molly. How may I help you?
Hey, Molly. I'm Adam Farmer, an investigative storyteller. If it's possible, I'd like to talk with the mayor.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's not taking any calls at the moment, but if you could leave me a number and a short message, I can run it by him. But being completely honest, Adam, don't get your hopes up. Many reporters have called trying to get an interview, and they were told that all he had to say was in his public statement. So unless you have something new, you should stick with that.
I gave her my number and thought for a few moments of what message to leave for the mayor that would interest him enough to talk to me. Molly was kind enough to give me time to think. I thought about the stuff that would have already been asked by previous reporters. I'm sure they are constantly asking him about his relationship with Ebony, so I knew that was off the table. I don't want to lead with a discussion of the crime scene because he may still not be ready to think back to that day. And it's also a heated political subject that he's probably currently dealing with. Then, I find out the perfect way to get his attention.
Hey, Molly. Just tell him I said her slippers weren't ruby, were they? I hope he'll understand what I mean.
I think that's mysterious enough to get his attention. I cross my fingers and spend the rest of the day looking around at the shops in downtown Munchkin City. I'm sitting at the Yellow Brick Roadhouse, devouring the best cheeseburger I've ever had, when I receive a phone call from the mayor's office.
Hi, Adam. This is Molly from the mayor's office. Great news. The mayor wants to talk with you, but it would need to be a quick interview over the phone because he has meetings all day. Does 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon work for you?
Yeah, that sounds perfect. Thank you, Molly.
It worked. I threw up the Hail Mary, and it scored the touchdown. I spent the rest of that night in my hotel room preparing for this interview. I wanted to get everything right. I started to feel like this was where I would begin to find the answers I'm looking for. The call came at exactly 1 o'clock.
Hey, Adam, it's Molly from the mayor's office. Let me transfer you over to him right away.
I waited on hold for a few seconds. They were playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, sung by Judy Garland, which felt like a weird song to play when someone's on hold. But luckily, I'm quickly transferred and find myself talking directly to the mayor of Munchkin City.
Hello there, Mr. Farmer. Molly tells me that you were eager to talk to me. Any other person I would turn down, but you seem to be different from the others.
In what way am I different? Just curious.
Well, for starters, you don't call yourself a journalist. What even is an investigative storyteller?
Well, sir, firstly, I call myself that because I try to tell other people's stories. Stories that aren't ordinarily heard. But being completely honest, I call myself that because I don't exactly have a degree in journalism.
I'll take that. Well, to get down to business, what did you mean by your message about slippers not being ruby?
Well, Mr. Mayor, I mean ebony slippers, the ones that were stolen from her the day she died.
I went through this with the OBI. She had different shoes she would wear out. I honestly don't remember which ones she wore that day. There was a lot of other stuff on my mind.
Sorry. I guess I was so excited to talk to you that I forgot to express how sorry I am for your loss.
Just hard, you know? Wondering what could have happened if she didn't. You know, we were repairing us, getting back together. I loved her. And I just think about if she was still here, we may have gotten married, had kids. But now that it won't happen, thanks to that witch killer.
I keep hearing Ebony referred to like that, like a witch. What does that mean? I mean, I know the wizard commanded each of the four lands to have a witch in a place of power, but does that mean Ebony knew magic and all that stuff?
Well, most witches do. Ebony didn't. But that didn't stop her. She learned sciences and alchemy. She used those skills to become appointed as the Witch of the East. She couldn't say magic words and turn people into toads. That she could transform one form of matter into another form by way of alchemy.
There's a lot of debate surrounding alchemy and its validity, even in this world where magic exists. Magic and science are ordinarily two opposing sides, so when alchemy brings the two together, let's just say it gets a little weird and confusing. If Ebony understood this stuff, she was smarter than I previously thought.
She sounds like a special person.
She was. We were actually on our way to her place so she could show me one of her newest discoveries when it happened.
I'm sorry. Is there anything else you can tell me about that day? I just want to find the truth.
No, but wait, hold on. Yes, I knew it.
What?
That day we took a walk downtown and decided to have our photo taken at the gazebo.
I quickly caught on to where he was going with this.
The slippers, are they visible?
Yes.
Well, I'm sorry for my eagerness, Mr. Mayor, but I need to know what color they are.
They're silver.
Thank you for listening to Fiction Crime Time. This episode was written and narrated by me, Adam Farmer. It featured the voice talents of Michelle Lee, Connor McGuire, Mitchell Witcher, Zachary Tellez, and Nicholas Gilliman. Be sure to follow Fiction Crime Time on social media at Fiction Crime Time on Instagram and Facebook. Also, give these awesome voice actors a follow. Just look for their socials in the description. A new episode will be released every other week, so be on the lookout for episode 3 on Groundhog Day, February 2nd. It's always a good thing to listen to while watching a groundhog predict the weather. And always remember, everyone has a story to tell. So, go tell yours. Thanks for listening.